we are addressing what we think is the biggest problem in the information age. And that is that everybody controls your information except for you. Data is the new oil, and everybody is collecting the oil that you're producing and making money from it. Everybody already knows this. Data brokers are evil. Most people don't realize how much money data brokers make. $100 billion a year, depending on which analysis you're looking at. You know, $2 billion a day.
Right.
But these companies are making, stealing your data and selling it without your permission behind your back.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Hello and welcome back to Founders on Chain. I am your host, Kyle, and today we're tackling the $500 billion data broker industry and why every startup that's tried to give users control of their data has failed. Joining me are Zach Wickstrom, founder and CEO of Vault, and his CCO, and Jarrett Truitt. They've studied every failed attempt at building a data marketplace, from DataCrew in 2012 to countless VC-backed startups that hit the same chicken-and-egg problem. You need 10 million users to have a viable marketplace, but paying them each $10 a month costs $1.2 billion annually. Vault cracked the code differently. Breakthrough? An exclusive partnership with Sentinel's decentralized VPN that brings in users now with a product that they actually want and pay for. They've also invented EasyEye, a cryptographic protocol 10,000 times faster than industry standards, solving the technical problem of how to manage all that data. With 20,000 monthly active users and actual revenue, they're already profitable while scaling to that critical 10 million user threshold. Let's find out how they got there.
How are you guys doing today?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing good, man. I've been checking out Vault, and I got some questions here prepared. Hope you're ready to answer some stuff.
Absolutely. Can't wait.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so the first thing that stood out to me when I pulled up your LinkedIn was a quote on there that you believe software is the best tool for effecting positive change. Can you expound on that? Like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, like, if you think about most businesses make stuff, you know, products or services, and that requires like the manipulation of physical atoms in the universe. You have to build the chair, or at least build the materials so that your user can build the chair if you're IKEA, or you have to pay people to go clean the houses, whatever your business is. And software is this amazing hack to this, where once you've written the code, that's it. There's no more overhead. It's just a distribution problem, which is insanely cheap. So you can choreograph electrons with Python and change the world like much easier than you can like with any other means of deploying change.
Do you have any examples that you can point to back up this claim?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the fact that we're talking from 1,000 miles away instantly over the internet, right? I mean, all of the software that's happening, the magic behind the scenes that's allowing this call to happen. Somebody said at some point that technology, sufficiently advanced technology, is indistinguishable from magic, right?
It's one of my favorite quotes.
Yeah. And so this is sort of the gist of what I mean in LinkedIn, and why I pivoted eventually to technology. Is it's like, okay, I want to make a good positive change in the world, and the most effective way to do that is to write code.
Okay. I see that your background is like, you've worked for some pretty big companies, looks like in the programming area, so that definitely seems like that is your passion. But can you tell me, like, what about those experiences at companies like Power and Wayfair led to, I guess, the need or what you're trying to do over at Vault?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in my like early 20s, I dropped out of college. I was studying music theory, and I realized that if I want to be a musician, having a degree is pretty much unnecessary. And I was kind of soul searching. I was a real estate agent for a little bit, and I I realized what I just told you, where it's like software is, yeah. is because I like making cool stuff and it's like the ultimate paintbrush in a way. So I decided that I was going to sell everything that I own, and I moved to San Francisco and I joined a code boot camp called App Academy. Really risky, but it paid off. And I started working at various startups in Silicon Valley with the ambition of building my own startup. And I figured the best way to do that is to work for a bunch and get good lessons and like anti-lessons, et cetera. And Power in particular was, I think, the best startup I had ever worked for. In terms of, yeah, just like the culture was amazing. It felt like a family away from family. And it taught me a lot about how to build a good company. I also had a lot of lessons about how to not do that. And then Wayfair was a huge enterprise where I was a cog in a wheel. They have 30,000 engineers or something. And so going from a scrappy San Francisco startup to like a Fortune 500 company and sort of everything in between equipped me with what was needed to build a company, a tech company, but also the underlying theme at all of these companies was that as an engineer, I have way more access to people's data than they do. And that's creepy. And that's freaky. Like this is the information age. And everybody controls your information except for you. And sure. So it slowly became clear that this was the problem that we wanted to solve.
Dude, did you guys pitch at Boston Blockchain this year or past years?
Yeah.
Actually, I swear yeah. I've seen. Okay, I swear this is.
I was going to say, yeah.
All right.
He's been
okay.
All over the place pitching this year.
All right. This all year, right.
Yeah, has been quite the rounds. Because do you know Sergey with Game
Yeah,
Ventures?
Yeah, Game Ventures. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Okay. That explains where I saw you guys. So something you mentioned when you talked about Wayfair and Power in particular, you said the culture there was spectacular. So, like, what did you learn about building a culture then? Because my experiences have been is like that's something that's really hard to change if you start out with something that's not great.
Yeah, yeah, you get like cultural inertia, and if there's right. toxicity, it's really hard to purge that. And I think Ben and Josh were just really good, like technical founders, but also had like excellent soft skills and could vibe check very well. They had this policy where new employees were always contractors for 3 months. And this is kind of just like a probational period. And then if you do the work and you actually jive with the team, then you're extended a full-time offer. So this was a really good thing. Mm-hmm. But they also would get us lunch. You know, it would be like every morning at 11 o'clock, the office manager would ask me what I want for lunch. You know, it's like, we're getting right, this, right. we're going to this Chinese restaurant. Here's the menu, pick something out. And it was cheap for the company because it's bundled, but it's also like when you break bread with people on a daily basis, that's a really cool, it was a cool thing. And it was kind of back in the old time. It was before COVID, right?
Oh, and right. So, yeah.
It was a different world. Like our team is fully distributed. We're about to bring somebody on in the UK. We just bought somebody on who lives in Turkey, and we're all over the world. So we don't have that, but the ethos of that business culture where, you know, Google had this study where they were looking into like which of their teams are more effective and which of their teams are least yeah. effective and what are the biggest contributing factors. And what they found is that psychological safety is the most important factor for a high performing team.
Really?
Psychological safety being like, you feel like you're validated, like you can throw out a crazy idea and nobody's going to think that you're stupid or something. You can ask a question and no one's going to think that you're stupid. Like it's assumed you work at Google, right? So you can just kind of be whatever kind of flower child you want. And the teams that did that the most ended up being the most productive. And so I try to bring that into, you know, I think, and Jarrett too, like our leadership style is like, nobody's done this before. Right. So who's anyone to say like what the right way to do it is? Let's like leave no stone unturned. Yeah.
It's interesting meeting somebody with a coding background such as yourself that actually has a pretty good grasp on like people skills. Those tend to seem to be unicorns in my experience. No offense, guys, but Jarrett, do you want to tell me a little bit like how did you guys get hooked up together then?
So I first met Zach at the gym, actually, and he had all the people skills in place before he had any of the coding skills. So that's where I used to live with him when he went to go to his coding boot camp, and he was like, you need to come. You should come do this. And my life just didn't pan out that way at the time. I was a landscaper, and that was, I was owning a business and running that. Finally, he came back a few years later, and we've just been hanging out ever since. And he's been talking to me about Vault. And eventually one day I was like, hey, I got lots of ideas. And I started designing all these different ways to visualize data. And the main thing that drives me is just different ways that we can, what we can do with data and what we can show people and how small the community is that actually understands what they're doing with your data. And when I say they, I mean everybody, marketers, advertisers, you know, anybody that can buy your data. So you can see that basically any Joe on the street can buy your data and find out who you are or anything about you. Anybody can stalk you. And so why can't you stalk yourself? Why can't you just see what do they know about you? And so that's what we've been working on. And I've been here with him for the past year, just almost every day. We just get together and build cool things. And like he said, and anything's possible because no one's built this before. We just got to, I have probably 50 different mock-ups and different websites of designs of where we can take this app. And we're just building it every day.
It's an incredibly fun thing to work on.
So I don't really have background like he does, but. Or the people skills, but I'm building them up every day. And
well, he's like being humble. You know, I will say,
it sounds like he's got all the business skills, is what I heard.
Yeah, like he's been running his own business for over a decade now, right?
Yeah.
Let's not gloss over that. I mean, my wife knows a lot of that stuff for me. I have no idea how any of it works. If I didn't have her, I'd be completely lost.
Well, and I think what it comes down to is just like a willingness to work hard and throw yourself into something. And you know, Jared's like taught himself like five programming languages. He pushes code, but he also does design stuff. He also does like Web3 development and like strategy. So
That's an interesting thing that you bring up when you kind of mentioned like the training and education, which you're kind of hinting at there. But like on these new cutting edge fields, there really isn't like programs necessarily to go and like learn some of this stuff. So like, how do you stay up to date? How do you like educate yourself and get the skills needed to be, you know, successful in this industry?
Yeah.
I mean,
he's given me a lot. We actually learn a lot from each other, like getting together and just doing things, you know? So at first he wasn't even writing code in an IDE or whatever. I was
still using Atom.
Yeah. I was using VS Code and I was like, man, you got to see like the things you can do inside of this. And so we just learn different things from each other every day.
That's true. I have more of the like old school curmudgeon, I feel like, neckbeard. experience. And this is why I wasn't even using fucking VS Code, you know, because it's like, this works. I don't need anything else. Okay. At least I wasn't using Vim, you know? But Jared is really good about finding new tools, trying them out. And like when they're good, telling the team about them. And he keeps me sort of like on the edge of new tool use. And then for me, it's like, I will learn about things in the context when they're needed. You know, like we developed our white paper, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I developed what I thought was kind of a naive solution for this that at scale we would modify and like let the professors tell us how to do zero knowledge proofs. But one of our investors asked us to release a white paper on the technology we developed. So I was looking into it and in so doing realized like, no, actually what we're doing is 10,000 times faster than the industry standard. And it's quantum resistant, sort of that's baked into the architecture. And so like inadvertently learning a lot of things that in context, you know, it's like the opposite of college. Like if you want a degree in computer science, you have to take French and British history or whatever, like, because it's enrichment. This is just like hyper-targeted kind of self-education.
I see that. If you have the discipline for it, it feels like the most effective. But, man, sometimes it's hard to, to work up that motivation to learn some of that stuff. Last question I have for the two of you guys, then we can move on to some more technical stuff. But working with with friends, like tell me about some of the challenges that maybe you guys have to deal with that if you guys didn't have maybe such a close relationship might make things easier maybe, or does it – Do you push back on that idea?
I mean, there are fights, you know. it's pretty rare, but I mean, there's conflicts sometimes. Everybody's pretty mature on the team, though. But we've had to fire people too.
Yeah,
I had a really good friend who I was enthused to get on the team, And then he just wouldn't show up to meetings, and it was like he was not taking it seriously. And after a couple of weeks, it's like, well, you're fired. You're not part of this. That sucks.
But it's better when they work out quickly like that. At least, you know, you're not 2 years deep into somebody trying to train them. And
I'm a big believer in fail fast, you know?
Ah, yes, yes.
Yeah, try it. If it doesn't work, cut it off. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we knew we would work together well, because once we started, it went pretty easy. After a month or two, if it wasn't going well, we both are so...
Right.
Yeah, he's like me. He would have just been like, this is bullshit.
Yeah, our minds would have conflicted so much that we would have just been like, it's not productive, but we can sit down and just get a lot of stuff done. And there's a lot of pushback. He'll be like, I don't like that. And I'm like, well, it's going to work. And we don't like it today. We'll change it in a week. But we just got to get this feature out. You know, we can't just keep sitting here as a VPN app. So,
yeah.
That's, like you said, we've had to fire people. And that's how I've gotten to the position where I am. We started out and I was just kind of like an intern, like learning the code, moving around the code. And our designer guy at the time was too busy to do anything for us, really. And it was taking months to get anything. And one day I just opened up Figma and was like, here we go. I'm going to learn how to storyboard and make this whole app, and made the whole app. And from there I was like, yo, let's redesign it like this. And then that's where we are.
Yeah.
Wow. Dude, that's awesome, man. I love hearing stories like this. All right. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about what you guys are doing with Vault then? Why don't you give me like the high level pitch? Like what's the problem that we're solving here?
Let me share my screen.
Yep.
Right. So as I was saying, we are addressing what we think is the biggest problem in the information age. And that is that everybody controls your information except for you. Data is the new oil, and everybody is collecting the oil that you're producing and making money from it. Everybody already knows this. Data brokers are evil. But what most people don't know, most people don't realize how much money data brokers make. $500 billion a year, depending on which analysis you're looking at. But
so that seems low, actually, doesn't it?
Right? Yeah. This is this is maybe a conservative estimate. And when you think about the magnitude of that number, it's like, you know, $2 billion a day.
right.
But these companies are making, stealing your data and selling it without your permission behind your back. That's like five apples combined, their net annual profit. And it's growing quickly. And it's shady, and lawmakers are not happy about it. This is why we have GDPR. This is why we have CCPA. More recently, the EU, dropped their EU Data Act, which explicitly they're trying to build a data marketplace. They are trying to foster a new economy of data where people can take control of their data and sell it at their own discretion. So lawmakers around the world want a consensual data marketplace like this. The question is, why doesn't it exist? And when we set out in this adventure, we quickly learned why it doesn't exist. And that's because there's a big chicken and egg problem. Mm. In order to have a data marketplace, you need a lot of data. You need about 10 million users actually contributing data to your marketplace on a regular basis.
Right.
And those people that are enriching your marketplace expect to get paid for their data. They should be making $10 a month, or else they're not going to be interested. Ideally even more. And so 10 million users, $10 a month, that means you're paying out your users $1.2 billion a year. This is the chicken and egg problem. You need a massive war chest in order to get a marketplace off the ground like this. And you need the trust in order to do it. Like companies that are not trusted, like X or Facebook or whatever, that may even have the resources, just simply don't have the social positioning to pull it off. And a lot of companies, startups, have tried to raise VC money. They'll raise, $8 million. One of the first, we've looked at all of the startups that have tried to build what we're building and that have failed, because we want to learn from how they failed. Generally, so the first one that we found was this company called Dataku. They were founded in 2012 in New York. Mm-hmm. They had like a Chrome extension where they would pay people $8 a month for their browsing data. And they had no shortage of people sign up. And they're paying all these people for their data, but they couldn't sell the data. They weren't able to find a buyer before running out of runway and went out of business. They're pretty much defunct.
That sounds like sharp people just waiting for them to run out of money and then to go scoop up the data for pennies on the dollar.
And that's right. It's like 23andMe.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, like, God. Yeah.
So egregious. Like tens of millions of people's genomes sold at auction, bro. Like, right. What?
Yes. Oh, man, I lost my mind when I saw that.
It's infuriating and it's creepy, you know, and this is why we're doing this. Right. And so we have to defeat the chicken and egg problem. And our solution to doing that is simple. It's to make data actually useful for users, right? Like, your data is incredibly useful for Google or for Meta. Why isn't it useful for you? The answer is because those tools just simply haven't been built yet. And that's that's largely what we're doing. We're building an exclusive product that only we can build, that people want now. People are currently paying us for our premium services. And this is a profitable, scalable business model that can be scaled up to the 10 million users organically, where we can basically just turn on the data marketplace when we're at sufficient scale. So this is our go-to-market strategy. And what I want to emphasize is that it's an exclusive product. If anybody else tried to copy our go-to-market strategy, they wouldn't be able to.
Why is that?
It's because of our exclusive relationship with Sentinel. So we're partnered with the Sentinel Foundation, and they have, you know, basically the only DVPN service, the world's premier DVPN service. And the nature of our partnership is any emerging data marketplace that would want to partner for Sentinel wouldn't be able to. That is the nature of our exclusivity. And so in some sense, we've monopolized this go-to-market. Exactly. And this is a feature that is really bringing in that first wave of users for us. A quarter of the world's population uses a VPN regularly. This was a shocking statistic when I first heard this. But
how much did you say?
25%. 2 billion people.
Jeez.
It's just insane. Yeah. And maybe that's a quarter of the internet population, you know, but it's in this order of magnitude. It's like a huge chunk of the human pie relies on a VPN.
It's actually surprising. I would have thought the most appealing aspect when I was looking through the website would have been the ability to analyze the data that you're collecting. Like, hey, I want to see track my spending habits over, you know, these certain months maybe or anything like that. I think the flexibility and the ability to like learn a bunch of stuff about yourself is fascinating to me.
Yeah, I completely agree. This is the part that we're most excited about. Mm-hmm. It's just not fully available to users yet, because we want to make sure that when we deliver our Vault AI, and this is the piece that we're talking about, this is incredibly exciting, right?
Yeah.
The ability to Google your life.
Right.
It's like, so it's one of these things that when you hear it, it's quite obvious. Once you have it, you won't be able to imagine life without it. This is like really the big thing, but this is hard to build, of course. And we want to make sure we're building it securely. And so look forward to this in 2026 in the Vault app.
Yeah.
This will be a major draw for us. And we have features like this, like what you're seeing in this slide is our personal database. So you can go through and basically have a digital diary of everything you've ever done, what your heart rate was on New Year's Eve last year. It's just that we don't have the AI piece fully integrated with that. And we think that's going to be a game changer.
I think what should be most eye-opening to anybody listening to this is how much data is actually being collected on you right now. People have your heart rate.
It's all out there, right? What Vault allows you to do is have all the data that pertains to you in a vault, in a secure place that only you can access. We can't access it. And we can get into the details of that when we get to sort of the white paper drop segment.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things to me, like how you're protecting that data from hackers. Like, it seems like every week we're turning on the news and hearing about another data breach.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's like you just said, you can tell that the Vault AI is in demand because a lot of companies are trying to do the same thing. Like ChatGPT wants you to connect all your apps to it so that it can get to know you better. But how do you know that you could trust that company? Because now they're going to take that data and train their next AI on it. And so, you know, you just can't trust what they're doing. And that's why we're trying to put that trust in the user's hands. So that's like, here's the data, you own it, and no one else can see it.
From what I understand, you guys can't even see it. You're collecting the data, but you can't even access it.
Yeah. We're building tools that enable the user to collect their own data and to eventually monetize it. But yeah, we have no idea who any of the data belongs to.
What about the storage of it? Useful.
Say what?
Oh, sorry, what about the storage of it? Like how I guess,
yeah.
Do you have to rent that? Like, how is that handled?
That is a fantastic question. And the high level answer, I suppose, is that we've invented an entirely novel way to store this data, such that it's provably private, but can still be monetized. There's a bit of a sort of seeming paradox. If you have a data marketplace, you need to be able to market the data. We mm-hmm. need to be able to say, like, 10 million people bought Nike tennis shoes last week. You need to know something about your market, right?
Right.
But then on the other side, it needs to be totally private and anonymous. So how do you resolve that paradox? And this is where, you know, I feel like we're teasing the white paper, which is cool. Because as technical as it is, you know, it makes it more exciting as we build up to it. But let me get through the rest of sort of offering.
Okay.
So we have the DVPN piece. And again, this is bringing in a majority of our users. We have it's free with ads or $9.99 a month with Vault Plus. Another Vault Plus feature is our data erasure suites. So you may have heard of companies like Delete Me or Incogni. They'll reach out to data brokers on your behalf and force them to delete the data that they have about you on a regular basis, like once a month or so.
I didn't even know that was an option.
Yeah. Awesome. And it helps a lot. You know, you're going to get less spam calls and emails and texts. If you sign up for Vault Plus or Vaultimate, we have the same coverage as Delete Me or Incogni. Except we deliver that at a fraction of the cost. It also comes with the VPN and eventually the AI stuff, which we were talking about a moment ago. You know, this go ahead. Sorry.
How much does a VPN typically cost just for the VPN? Like, I'm pretty sure those are close to like $9 or $10 a month at this point. You're getting all this other stuff with that. That seems amazing.
That's exactly it. You know, we tried to price this as competitively as possible, where it's like, the price point is comparable to a NordVPN or a Surfshark, but you get so much more. It's qualitatively better than NordVPN or Surfshark, because Nord owns all their servers. You know, like, if they want to, they can spy on you, even though they pinky promise they're not doing that. Right. And this, in fact, happens all the time, right? With the DVPN, that's fundamentally impossible. So it's just like the value proposition is not arguable. We're trying to be the Tesla of data sovereignty, right?
I like that. but I mean, the goal too is I would think the goal is to get users at this point. So I don't think the main plan is to make money off of subscriptions. I think the main plan is to make money off of allowing the users to sell data and then taking your cut of that. Correct.
That is the high level sort of master plan for Vault.
Right.
We need the subscription revenue for phase one.
Right.
In order to achieve like perpetual solvency and scale up to 10 million users. And then at 10 million users, we get the second order effect of the data marketplace, which we've already built out the infrastructure from. We can literally just press the on button, right?
So it's all ready to go. You're just waiting to hit the metric.
Precisely. Awesome. And you know, as soon as we have an app where you can just download this app and set it up and then it pays you $10 a month or more, mm-hmm. that's going to spread like wildfire. It's going to be like, who wouldn't do that? Your data's out there anyway. You should take control of it. You'll get paid to do so, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so currently we're at a very early stage. We are closing out our seed round currently, but we are revenue positive. We're in the sub 1% of projects that we're making money today. We have 20,000 or so monthly active users, and we've had months where we grow 400% in a single month.
Oh wow!
And so the potential for explosive growth is quite high, and we're backed by Gain Ventures. They're our lead investor, so that's been an amazing. I mean, I think has afforded this connection with this podcast.
Yeah, I love our friends at Gain Ventures. Anastasia is amazing.
They're just the most wonderful people. You know, I had a certain perspective of what venture capitalists were going to be like, but I have to say, like, Sergey and Sveta are just they're just the most human, warm people. I guess what I was thinking is like, have you ever seen the TV show Silicon Valley?
Oh God, yeah, I love that show. Yeah. When you said you invented your own method of storing data, that was immediately what I was thinking of. Like, oh, they can do algorithm?
Right. It's called Pied Piper V1. Right. No. That's what I used to think, too, and then I saw it. it's pretty elegant, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we're teasing that. Let's keep doing that. Anyway, so I want to just quickly mention that we have the dream team. Everybody that you're seeing here on our team slide is deeply experienced in their domain and has really put in the blood, sweat, and tears. Everybody is not taking a salary on the team. We are doing this out of sheer belief that this is something that the world needs. People are not like, why doesn't this exist yet? And so we've decided that we're going to be the ones that make it happen. And again, hopefully this team slide expands slightly in the next couple of weeks here with our latest team member. And just some details on our seed round. We're targeting a $20 million valuation, and we're raising $3 million in equity or SAFT capital. And the $3 million is going to help us achieve the 10 million users much more quickly. We'll be able to do it in 18 to 24 months. And, you know, the goal is to, in that 18 or 24 months, actualize the data marketplace, make that a real thing. Everything we were just describing, hit 10 million users, pay people $10 a month for their data. When we achieve this, we'll be the first company in history to do so. And this easily justifies a $1 billion valuation. You know, so we're going from 20 million to 1 billion. That's a 50x increase on your investment. You know, if you're a Web3 AI tech investor, this may be one of the best opportunities. And we want to position ourselves so that in our Series A and in our future rounds, our interests are strongly aligned with the giants of the industry. We want Google and Amazon and Meta on our board, because that represents, you know, a discount for them for the purchase of data. But, you know, our company is also positioned to be the force that holds other tech giants accountable in data usage. And that kind of segues into this final quote that I'll leave you with, which is that Sam Altman was quoted somewhat recently saying that he thinks the killer app for AI is going to be an LLM with total access to all of your conversations, every email that you've ever had. It knows your heart rate on New Year's Eve, but that it doesn't feel creepy, that it's totally private. I don't think Sam said that last part, but we're saying that last part.
I prefer that last part.
that's the high level pitch. And, you know, I would love to sort of zoom into any of that now that you have the landscape.
So, I mean, well, can we just like take a step back then and like, how did we get here with data and data rights in general? How did we lose those as consumers or as, you know, person? How did we lose control of our data?
We never had them, right? If you think about like yellow pages, remember before the internet?
Oh, geez. Yeah, I didn't.
All your shit was just out there. Your address, right. Your phone number. I think that society, like the parsing of information was more labor intensive. And so it was less risky to have your data out there. Now your data can be scraped by AI. You know, you can ask Grok to stalk somebody for you, and it can probably do it pretty effectively if you prompt engineer well enough.
That's scary.
Yeah. And so the need for enforcing that digital privacy has just become naturally more prevalent.
So you mentioned EU is building one of these marketplaces as well. Have you guys had any conversations with anybody over there like to try to make sure that when they're ready to, you know, go for something that you guys are, hey, we got it right here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We were actually just in Croatia a few weeks ago for Cosmoverse 25.
Were you in Zagreb?
I was in Split, which is beautiful. It was like Monaco. There were so many yachts.
I didn't realize.
But it's also not pretentious. Like, I feel like Monaco, everybody's going to be like, meh.
Right.
You've got to chill.
Right.
And everything's cheap. I love Croatia. Couldn't recommend it enough. But I had the opportunity and privilege to meet some of the current and former like EU representatives, especially as it pertains to technology and data privacy. And so what the EU has done is they haven't built a data marketplace. They've set up legal infrastructure to encourage the existence of, you know, and we did get quite a bit of attention at this conference. You know, people are really excited. The thing is, investors are almost jaded. When you mention this idea to investors, they're like, give me a break. They've heard it 1,000 times. It keeps failing. Nobody can pull it off. But I think at Cosmoverse, we demonstrated a go-to-market strategy and like a high-level deployment schedule, if you will, for making a marketplace work.
No, I think what you guys are doing, because you're offering more than just the value of potentially selling your data in the future. You have physical things that are worth something now on offer that people can sign up for and start, you know, paying you guys and generating a revenue. Like, you're definitely better positioned than somebody who is just focusing on the data broker aspect of it, I would think.
I don't know if it's doable if you just focus on that.
Right, right. Not unless you're one of the companies that already has all the data or something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But then what's your incentivation then to share it with the people who are giving it to you? There's none.
Yeah, you're shooting yourself in the foot if you try to be Robin Hood all of a sudden, because you're actually the robber baron. You know?
Exactly. Why don't we take a look at the white paper then? Because what I'm really curious to see now then is how we are protecting this data from outside or from other people being able to hack into it or other breaches.
Yeah, our white paper is David and I are sort of featured as authors, but a lot of the team has contributed to some degree. So this list may expand, but you know, when we're building a data marketplace, the most important thing is the privacy of the data, for a number of reasons. Like, first of all, ethically, this is the right thing to do. This is the promise that you're making to your users. You need to keep your promise. But then when you think about it, from a cold and calculating perspective, your interests are also aligned, because the more secure the data is, the more it's worth.
You
have an economic incentive to lock it down. And so we realized that it needs to be super duper secure. Like, this is baked into our name, Vault, right? It needs to be utterly unhackable and zero knowledge identity too. Like, you can prove you own a piece of data without ever telling anybody who you actually are. Kinds of things like this. And this is like a kind of sophisticated mathematical schema. People have invented zero knowledge proofs. They're not new. They started being explored in like the 80s.
Okay. I just remember them talking about it at Boston Blockchain this year. I think it was the first time I'd been hearing it talked about regularly.
Right. Well, I mean, and zero knowledge proofs are the backbone for so much of Web3. You know, like, so many L1 blockchain technologies are built on zero knowledge proofs. A big one is ZK Snarks and ZK Starks. These basically took the academic ideals of zero knowledge proofs and pulled it into the mainstream somewhat for blockchain and made a lot of things possible. The problem is they're really slow. And when you have a data marketplace where you have, say, a billion users all creating 1,000 breadcrumbs, data breadcrumbs a day, trillions of breadcrumbs a day, right? Like, it needs to be really, really, really fast. And
definitely can't be slow.
No. Like, there's this metric in the white paper where we use this case. Let's say you get a new phone and you use Vault. And you need to sync your Vault account with a year's worth of data, your past data. It needs to go securely download all that so that it's synced up for you. If you were to use ZK Snarks to do this, that sync would take 42 days, up to 42 days. And with EZI, our technology, it takes about 300 seconds. It makes things that were previously not possible now, like, something that can be production ready, like consumer grade. So, you know, we won't go into the details of how it works too much. I'll just try to cover like what's important about it and the high level idea. It's actually really elegant. You get two private keys with EZI. You get an I key and a var key, and you can kind of think of these almost like two strands of DNA. They build up your digital identity, and crucially, they're top secret. Your device generates these numbers, and only your devices have these numbers. They're never sent over the internet. And this allows you to basically tag your data in a really, really secure way. And the best way to think of it is, it's like clock math, you know, like, let's say we have a clock, 12-hour clock. Yeah. The clock starts off at midnight. Now, if I move it 3 hours, it shows 3 o'clock. Right.
Yeah.
And if you ask the question, like, how many hours did I change the clock? Easy answer, it's 3 hours. Now, but let's say I rotate it 15 hours. Mm-hmm. Then the clock's pointing at 3 o'clock. Right. But there's no way to know that I actually rotated it 15 hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or if you do whatever, like 1,500, some multiple of that, where it still points to the three, there's no way to know the number of rotations on this clock. And this is the power of modular arithmetic. And so your two keys are like two clocks. The two big random numbers that are co-prime are like two clocks, except they have billions of hours. Mm-hmm. And when you tag your data, you're basically choosing an hour that both of these clocks are pointing to. Like they're pointing at the same direction. If you can see my screen, you know, these clocks are always sort of, and then you just simply randomly pick a number of rotations for each of these clocks. And this gives you your I key and your var key. Now, the magical thing about this is if you have those two clocks, you can always find your data in a haystack of data, because it's all of the data points where the tags end up with the clock faces perfectly aligned, right?
Right.
And then any data that's not yours, they're not going to agree. You don't know who the data is, but you know it's not yours.
How many points is this, I guess, measuring? Like, are these actual points that it's I guess, like, tagging it with? And how many of those per data piece, I guess?
So each individual, what we like to call breadcrumb of data, gets its own tag. So like a single GPS coordinate, a single Taylor Swift song that you listen to, a purchase, you know, a browser event. All of these little discrete breadcrumbs are useless on their own. It's how they stitch together that is actually immensely valuable. And so what EZI allows us to do is obfuscate the relation between these data points. But we can still collect these individual breadcrumbs that are obfuscated. And this allows us to do things with our data marketplace, right? Like we were talking about. So now suddenly we can be like, hey, 10 million people bought a pair of Nike tennis shoes last week. We don't know who they are, but we know that happened.
You don't need to know at this point. Yeah,
precisely. And then somebody who's, let's say, Reebok uses the Vault Marketplace. They're like, we want to know everybody that bought Nike tennis shoes last week. We're willing to pay them $4 for their purchase data, their browsing data within the last 2 months leading up to that purchase or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. They build their own campaign. They basically make offers to eligible users. And then the marketplace itself facilitates the thing based on the architecture with which it's been set up. We don't ever have to know. We just get paid for having facilitated the thing. And so that is the EZI promise. That's the Vault data marketplace, all the way down to the way the bits work. And this clock modular arithmetic is beautifully simple compared to other technologies. We have a slide in this paper where it goes through and talks basically just it's almost talking shit because it's like,
just comparisons.
We don't need advanced this. We don't need fucking Fourier transform for this. It's just like adding numbers together and then getting the remainder. It's ridiculously simple, but that makes it cheap and fast. You know, at a billion users, this would cost us $1,500 a month. Which is pennies. If you're a company with a billion users, 1.5 million a month is, it's like your lunch budget. That's your morning coffee. So
yeah, that's nothing.
Yeah. So this is the way that that's a very bird's eye view of the white paper, why it's important.
Is that on your website if anybody wanted to go and find it and read it like in depth?
Yes. Nope. Yes. Hit up vaultdata.com/investors. And we have our deck and our white paper here. We decided that because there was sort of this question of, do we want to keep this proprietary technology under wraps or do we want to release it to the world? And what we kind of realized is that the right thing to do is release it because this is relevant potentially to a lot of other things other than just data marketplaces. And it's good for industry visibility for us too. So, I encourage you to sort of dive into the details if you're interested.
Yeah, man, for sure. I mean, probably going to need a little bit more than 5 minutes of looking through it to get some good questions, but we can come back to that one.
It's a hefty one. I know the ins and outs of the company, and I've been here for a long time. And then when I first read this, I was like, bro, we're really abstracting.
So was that you guys' first white paper? that you published, and that was just that was just recently, right? That was like 3 weeks ago, it looks like. What were the responses? Has anybody given you any feedback on it yet?
Yeah, we got some responses from the investor that recommended we release a white paper. Mm-hmm. was like, you know what? Never mind.
Whoops.
Because he was like, this is too technical. It's not really going to help. And he was right. You know, I was talking to Blake Griffin, the NBA 6-time champion, right?
Yeah, for the Clippers. Yeah.
He has his own VC. And so I was talking to him and his brother, and we were sort of in a due diligence phase. And mm-hmm. I sent them our white paper. And then, like, the next day, they were like, sorry, this is over our heads. And I was like, fuck. Come on.
So we need the team that. We need the high level overview then, right?
Right. Yeah. But you know, what we're seeking now is peer review, because
that, yes.
And some of our connections through the Cosmos ecosystem afford that for us, but getting it into the Journal of Cryptology, turns out the word is cryptology, is something that would give us that industry visibility, but also maybe unlock a lot of innovations in adjacent areas. Yeah.
Nothing else, just the collaboration that you get from people calling you and picking your brain, and then you get to do the information swap, idea swap, and yeah, I think it's worth it just for that.
It totally is. It's just such a beautifully simple idea. For a long time, I was like, there's no way that this can work because it's too simple. So like rigorous, like spent weeks making sure that it's like, yeah. You know, it's not like we just dreamed it up in its final form. That what you're seeing here is like a highly streamlined, like actualization of a high level concept. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. We have anything else on the technical side that we want to cover here?
I don't think so.
I guess why don't we let's take a look at the future then. Like, what's going on over at Vault right now? What do you guys have the eyes on? I mean, you said you're raising seed money. You're trying to get to that 10 million users. Is there anything else that you're cooking on? Does Jarrett have any more fun features that he's been test driving that are getting ready to be unveiled?
Oh, man, we're working on – main thing we want to do is get apps. We got to get all the apps you can add into the app. So we got to get people using the app so that we can mm-hmm. prove that – that's what people want. You know, one of the main things that has been driving us the past year is like what you said, how do we get to this problem of nobody really knowing why they want to protect their data. And it really starts with you sign up for everything and you get this terms of agreement and you scroll to the bottom, you can send it to yourself and you're never going to read it. And that's where we lost ourselves. You know, we agreed to everything and nothing at the same time. Mm. We don't know what we're agreeing to, but we're agreeing to it. And so that's one of the first things when I first got here is like, we got to show people what they're seeing when they sign up. You know, what is Spotify seeing when you listen? What are the marketers seeing when all of this data culminates? What profile are they creating about you? Because that's really what they're doing. And so for the past year, we've been thinking about how can we create this awareness, you know, because mm-hmm. we're trying to create this concept of data sovereignty that doesn't really exist. Like, we sat down a few months ago and we're like, what is the core concept? And that's really what we've trying to grasp and get to the core concept of is the data sovereignty aspect of it. So we're trying to visualize the data. So we need more data in the app so that I can, hey, this is what you're seeing when you're listening to Apple Music. This is what you're doing when you're on X. You know, this is what these advertisers are thinking about you. Mm. So we've brought in our data command center. If you sign up and you start to see like what the advertiser thinks about you, you're getting like a data score about how you're managing that data that's being leaked and how you're getting it back. And so we're cooking up our concept of what the data marketplace is going to look like someday. So that'll be unveiled for the people that want to become investors, and we'll be using that.
Yeah.
Like, hey, it's going to be really cool. Think of just being like an investor and being able to ask a question like, how many people were at the Costco in New Mexico the last month, and what was their average bill? What did they buy? You know, how can we target those people?
Can you get traffic patterns too?
Yeah.
Oh
yeah,
my gosh, there's so much cool stuff you can do.
There's so much cool shit, dude. There's so many cool things you can do. And so really the core of it is getting all of that data so that we can start trying to figure out how we can visualize it. So we got to create it ourselves in the app.
Right.
First, we have
right.
to make it so we can capture it. Then we got to make it ourselves by doing the actions, because we can't just go messing around with everybody else's data. So we physically have to use the app to create data that we can test. You know, the surface area of what we're building is immense, right? It goes in a lot of different directions. And yeah, we have sort of a Hello World suite of data integrations. You can log in with, you can connect your location, you can log into your bank, you can do Spotify, you can do your email, but it's a limited list. And part of the big reason for this is, you know, a lot of services don't have rich APIs for you to have control of your data. This seems like in principle wrong to me. But like, for example, Instagram has no API where you can just go see all of your likes. Same thing with Facebook. And X has this, but they charge you $50,000 a month to access it.
What?
yeah. And so it's like very difficult to find first party APIs for a lot of the things that people use, Amazon, Grubhub, whatever. And we're developing ways around this, because it's your data. You deserve it. You deserve to have control of it. You can control it however you want to. This is one of the vectors that we're really working on. But we're also building out in parallel our AI piece. We're kicking off a partnership with an organization called The Agentic. And they are highly selective. They find projects that are building AI tools and sort of vet them and pick about 1% of the ones that they're interested in. And then they'll help them develop these tools.
So that was actually the question I think I was going to ask you then. It was what you were doing, how you were planning on analyzing all this data that you're collecting. It sounds like that's the idea, develop your own AI to be able to parse it.
That's exactly right. It's like we need to build kind of our own version of ChatGPT. And the interesting like engineering challenge is that, you know, because of the nature of this, like a lot of the AI logic needs to be on the device. Your device is the only place where all of your data is aggregated together in one spot.
Right.
We wouldn't be able to do this on the server. And if we do cloud inference, where we send like a pre-compiled composed prompt from your device to an AI, we need to have that be like ultra secure, you know? And so these are interesting challenges. David and I and the team have been diving into it head first, but then we met the Agentic, and they're basically a team of like 12 AI experts that will help us build this out very rapidly. But the AI piece is going to be the thing that moves the needle in the near term the most. So that's another really exciting thing we're working on.
You guys have any fun stories?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like the main company story at this point is last October.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, so Sentinel offered to pay for me to fly out to Dubai for Cosmoverse 2024.
Dude, I've heard of that. It's awesome.
Yeah, it was amazing. No, they flew me out like premium Emirates. Amazing airline, you know, like you get a real like metal fork and spoon when they serve you airline food. And
actual
like,
food?
Actual food. Yeah, it was amazing.
I didn't think they did that
and
anymore.
If you stand up in your chair, there's actually enough room for you to fully stand up. It was an amazing flight experience. But anyway, we're going to go out to Dubai. It's like right before Halloween. And we went over to James's house, our other co-founder. And we're getting wasted, you know. We're like, holy shit, you know, we're gonna win this competition. It's like we're really, really excited. And Jared he's maybe the only sober one of the group. You know, he's drivable anyway, and he's leaving. And he's like, you guys don't get too fucked up so that you miss your flight in the morning. We're like, no, that's not never gonna happen. No. Then he missed the flight.
If we're telling secrets, I missed a flight from Italy at a work trip when they sent me up to Udine to go learn how to run a steel mill. There's a 2-week trip there. I got hammered in Venice, and I think I walked into the hotel room at 5. I set a wake-up call for 45 minutes later and obviously didn't make it.
Oh, my God.
Cost me €1,000 to buy a return flight home.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Yeah, that was our situation. That was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But but we're a small startup and we can't afford it. So his James' grandma actually funded it.
And James's fiance. So it was the whole squad kind of made that happen. So I was like crashing at James's house. He was going to take me to the airport in the morning. Yeah. And it was like a Rick and Morty episode or something. So I'm like in there. Then all of a sudden, James like dashes in the guest bedroom, kind of drunk. He's like, "Zach, it's like 7 in the morning. We have to go right now." And I was like, "Fuck!" You know, we're freaking out. We're still kind of just like stumbly trying to get to the airport. We might make it, and then there's just this traffic, fucking traffic at 0 o'clock in the morning. It's like, oh, holy shit, we missed the Dubai thing. Oh, fuck. Wait. Okay, so I'm going to fly to Seattle, hang out for 6 hours, then fly from Seattle to Dubai. This is fine, guys. As long as I can get to Seattle by 5 p.m. And so I go into the airport. I'm, like, talking to all the people, trying to find a flight. Like, nobody can get me there on time. Yeah. And I'm just like, fuck. Okay, this is the universe, like, flipping me off for being an alcoholic.
Oh, no. Did you not get to go to Dubai then? Did you not make
it? No, we were on the way back. To James's house, and his fiance called, and she was like, "There is a flight that lands in Seattle at 4 p.m. It's first class. Do you want me to get it?" And bless her heart, she got me a first class ticket last minute to Seattle, and so I got there, and like my plane landed like 40 minutes before the next flight was going to take off or something. So I'm like running through the Seattle airport. I was like studying the map of the airport before I was landing, so I knew exactly where the fuck to go, you know. And
luckily, SeaTac's not too big.
Yeah. Well, I got there. I like guessed the gate correctly because at some point it was like a random guess at the end. And I was like, "Fuck yeah!" Like the plane was still there, and the thing was still attached to the door and everything. And I go up, and I'm like, "Hey, I'm sorry, I'm late, it's Zach. You know, Zach Wakestrom." And they're like, "Sorry, we can't let you on." It was like,
it
was just like pissed. And this woman who was at the counter at Emirates, her name was Susan. She was just like the sweetest person ever.
Yeah.
And she actually hooked me up with the flight to Dubai the next day. So I missed the first day in Dubai, but I was able to go. And that was great because that really did kickstart our investor relations and everything. We wouldn't be where we are today if it weren't for all those things happening. But
I also gotta say too, I think that's the points of the culture that you guys kind of built around, that you had that many people willing to support you and help you get to where you needed to go. Like that, I think that just speaks to what you guys are building over there at Vault, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys end up doing in the future.
Absolutely, man. Yeah. I mean, it was shocking to me, but it warmed my heart that so many people kind of came together to make that happen. So yeah, well, it's been amazing talking today. Hopefully this is one of many. You know, I'd love to touch base in the future. We'll have updates in a few months for you.
Oh yeah, we can do as many of these as you guys want. You just let me know.
Special thank you to our guests and everyone listening for sticking around to the end. Zach and Jared are closing their seed round now, targeting a $20 million valuation and raising $3 million to reach 10 million users in 18 to 24 months. They're backed by Gain Ventures and already generating revenue with 20,000 monthly active users. Puts them in the top 1% of all Web3 projects. If you want to dive deeper into their technology, check out their white paper at vaultdata.com/investors. They've also invented EZI, a cryptographic protocol that's 10,000 times faster than the industry standard zero-knowledge proofs, making consumer-grade data marketplaces actually possible for the first time. For investors interested in AI, data privacy, or Web3 infrastructure, Vault represents a rare opportunity. A team solving a $500 billion problem with exclusive partnerships, proven technology, and a clear path to a $1 billion valuation. Till next time, keep listening, keep building, and keep sharing.